This spot is brought to you by Eaton Vance, the symbol of advanced investing. What's inside your ETF? With Parametric Equity Premium Income ETF, you know. Inside, you'll find institutional expertise from a specialized team with deep derivatives experience. Get to know what's inside PAPI, the symbol of alternative income, at eatonvance.com/symbols. Before investing, prospective investors should carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. The current prospectus contains this and other information and is available at eatonvance.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing. Not FDIC insured. Offer no bank guarantee. May lose value. Not insured by any federal government agency. Not a deposit. Investments involve risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Foreside Fund Services, LLC.
U.S. hiring is slowing. How the latest jobs report could take pressure off the Fed. Plus, billionaire investor Carl Icahn bows to activist pressure.
It does show that at least for Hindenburg Research, I think the kind of the threat of short activism, even to, you know, the kind of masters of the universe like Icahn, is not to be underestimated.
And private equity firm KKR is in advanced talks to buy Simon & Schuster. It's Friday, August 4th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. U.S. hiring was steady in July, with employers adding 187,000 jobs to the economy. The Labor Department also reported that the unemployment rate fell to 3.5%, near a half-century low. Wage growth was steady and still at a higher level than before the pandemic. The latest report, as we know, provides key data for the Federal Reserve as it weighs the path of rate hikes to combat inflation and slow the economy. Here now to break it down is Wall Street Journal labor economics reporter Sarah Cheney Cambon. Sarah, overall, this report adds to signs that we've been seeing that the economy is easing. Are we more or less on track for what the Fed wants to see?
What we saw is that hiring gains have slowed in recent months, and that included in July as well. And that's exactly what the Fed wants to see as they have raised interest rates over the past year and a half or so. They want to see a cooling economy. And so this report kind of adds to other evidence that that is indeed happening.
I want to pull out a couple of points here. Wage growth has become an area of increased focus lately. Why is that? Higher wages are good for workers, but not so much the Fed.
Absolutely. We all love a good pay raise. But for the Fed, it's worrisome because if companies are having to pay more for workers, they might pass along higher prices. And so that feeds into inflation, which, as you know, has been historically high over the past couple of years. It has come down recently, but the Fed wants to see it come down more to a level that is consistent with 2%.
Connected to pay gains slowing down, we're also seeing demand for workers easing. What does that mean for the labor market?
We are seeing that employers are less hungry to hire than they were a couple of years ago, or even a year ago when they were still recovering from the pandemic. We had lots of restaurants reopening and they were eager to hire, and they've been able to fill a lot of those roles. And as that has happened, we've seen this sort of slowdown in the labor market occur. And again, that aligns with the Fed's goal of seeing both the labor market cool and inflation come down.
So as we report, more people are entering the workforce, and at the same time, more people are immigrating to the U.S. What impact has that had on the labor market?
The rise in immigration has helped employers fill jobs. I mean, as you have more immigrants coming into the labor market, you have more workers. And that was a big issue for a couple of years. Employers were like, where are the workers? We don't have enough job applicants. And immigrants are a really key source of labor for employers. So as that's happened, we've seen that employers say it's easier to hire now. And because of that, they have not had to raise wages as much, which again, might not be great for workers, but it is good for the Fed.
Wall Street Journal labor economics reporter Sarah Cheney Cambon. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me, Anne-Marie.
Billionaire investor Carl Icahn has backed down from a fight with activist investor Hindenburg after the firm launched a campaign against his company earlier this year. Hindenburg alleged Icahn Enterprises was overvalued, that its dividend was unsustainable, and that Icahn, the man, had borrowed heavily against his shares. Today, Icahn bowed to that pressure, cutting its dividend in half to $1 a share. He also published a letter saying his company would again focus on corporate activism. Here now to explain how it happened is Wall Street Journal investigative reporter Ben Foldy. Ben, Icahn himself has long been known for exerting this type of pressure on companies to change their business. How did Hindenburg flip the script?
Yeah, so one of the things worth pointing out is kind of the difference in how Icahn and Hindenburg make their money. Icahn is kind of a traditional shareholder activist investor who buys a stake in a company like Apple, for example, and pressures the company's board or executives to kind of do something to the business that will make his long investment improve in value. You know, whether it's paying out a dividend or changing the business or even changing the CEO, anything like that. Hindenburg is what's called an activist short seller. So a short seller is an investor who kind of bets against a company, but the activist part is that they bet against the company and then they go public with their research, not to pressure the company, but to kind of influence the market into selling off those shares and making money on that. So there is an irony here. It's not that Hindenburg took a stake in Icahn Enterprises and then lobbied the board to change things around like Icahn would do. What Hindenburg did was took a really deep look at Icahn's financials, said, here are the reasons we think this is overvalued, here are the reasons we think that the dividend is unsustainable, published all that, took a short position, and then, you know, benefited from the decline in the stock price when the market, you know, ultimately seems to, at least for now, be agreeing with Hindenburg that the company was kind of impressively overvalued.
So what does this mean for Icahn and his business?
The short answer is nothing good. Icahn, in a lot of ways, has tacitly admitted several of Hindenburg's conceits while also calling the report misleading and self-serving. But Icahn was facing a lot of pressure from his lenders who he'd pledged the shares against. So last month came out with a new deal that said that he had now put most of the shares that he has, almost all of this company, up for collateral on these loans, as well as $2 billion of other assets. So he's kind of doubled down in a way and mortgaged even more of the company against his loans. And now the company has cut the dividend, which again is kind of a tacit conceit to Hindenburg that the dividend was probably unsustainable. And as you can see, the market, well, the shares are down more than 25% today, this morning, on pace for their worst day ever. So again, this is kind of a benefit to Hindenburg, who makes money when the stock goes down, and pretty hurtful potentially to Icahn. And one of the other things that Icahn said today was that the company was going to kind of refocus on its form of activism and buying up stakes in companies and unlocking value. The issue with that is that basically the value of Icahn Enterprises has gone from $18 billion to about $8 billion. So if your war chest is much smaller and you have a lot of collateral pledged to lenders, it's not totally clear where the money can come from to do that kind of activism. So he's in a pretty tight spot.
Wall Street Journal investigative reporter Ben Foldy. Thank you so much, Ben.
Of course.
Coming up, Democratic lawmakers flag North Korea's reliance on stolen cryptocurrency to fund its nuclear program as a severe national security threat. More, including how the Biden administration is responding after the break.
This spot is brought to you by Eaton Vance, the symbol of advanced investing. What's inside your ETF? With Parametric Equity Premium Income ETF, you know. Inside, you'll find institutional expertise from a specialized team with deep derivatives experience. Get to know what's inside PAPI, the symbol of alternative income, at eatonvance.com/symbols. Before investing, prospective investors should carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. The current prospectus contains this and other information and is available at eatonvance.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing. Not FDIC insured. Offer no bank guarantee. May lose value. Not insured by any federal government agency. Not a deposit. Investments involve risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Foresight Fund Services, LLC.
Three Democratic senators are pressing the Biden administration on its response to North Korea using billions of dollars in stolen cryptocurrency to fund its nuclear program. In a letter sent to the White House on Thursday, the lawmakers warn that Pyongyang's growing reliance on digital assets to evade sanctions is a severe national security threat. Joining me now to explain is Wall Street Journal cybersecurity and intelligence reporter Dustin Volz. Dustin, what do we know about how North Korea is funding its nuclear program?
Well, this has been a growing problem for some time that North Korea has been turning to cryptocurrency to fund its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program. In the past 5 years or so, North Korea has made off with about $3 billion in stolen cryptocurrency that it has used to fund its nuclear ambitions, according to analytics companies like Chainalysis. And U.S. officials tell us that that money is now accounting for about 50% overall of North Korea's funding to evade sanctions and continue to prop up its nuclear weapons program. That is a startling amount of money that North Korean hackers are getting and funneling straight to its weapons program. And it's startling, especially to a lot of U.S. officials, because as recently as last year, the estimates were that this was accounting for about a third of the overall funding.
So that brings us up to speed on what we have learned so far, and there is a lot that we don't know. What information are lawmakers seeking from the Biden administration?
Basically, these senators, and it's notable that it's, you know, Democratic senators demanding information from a Democratic administration, want to be briefed on how they're addressing this and whether or not there are more things that the Treasury Department specifically can do in terms of sanctions or other steps to better police and regulate the cryptocurrency industry to prevent bad actors like North Korean hackers from using them as a way to launder money out of the cryptocurrency ecosystem and then support their nuclear weapons program. Really sort of a notable thing. Again, you know, you don't see too often lawmakers from the same party as the White House somewhat aggressively saying, we want more information on what you're doing, and we find sort of what you've told us so far to be somewhat lacking. And so this problem is just sort of especially notable and acute because it's rather alarming that North Korea continues to be able to fund to the tune of $1 billion annually its nuclear weapons program. And it's also worth noting, of course, that all of this is happening, this cryptocurrency funding, at a time when North Korea is shooting off more ballistic missiles than years past.
Wall Street Journal cybersecurity and intelligence reporter Dustin Volz. Dustin, thank you.
Thank you.
A White House national security spokeswoman declined to comment on the letter, but pointed to previous remarks from senior officials highlighting the need to do more to combat the problem. A Treasury Department spokeswoman didn't comment on the letter either, but referred to earlier department actions seeking to constrict North Korea's crypto laundering operations. We report exclusively that private equity firm KKR is in advanced talks to acquire book publisher Simon & Schuster for about $1.65 billion. That's according to people familiar with the situation. It's the second time parent company Paramount Global has put the company up for sale, after a federal judge blocked a previous deal with Penguin Random House over concerns the tie-up would unlawfully lessen competition in the space. Simon & Schuster, the third largest U.S. book publisher as measured by market share, is nearly a century old and has published authors including Stephen King and Bob Woodward. KKR manages more than $500 billion in assets and is invested in the German media conglomerate that owns Politico and Business Insider. And in another scoop, we report that the United Auto Workers Union is demanding a 40% pay hike for its factory workers at General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. That would be the largest increase in recent memory. The UAW is negotiating with Detroit automakers over new four-year labor agreements for about 150,000 hourly workers. A UAW spokesperson said that during the current contract, the average CEO salary at the Detroit car companies has increased 40%, saying the union members deserve the same, if not more. GM said it plans to increase wages for workers, but that the union's demands as they currently stand would threaten its long-term ability to support hourly workers. Ford said it looks forward to working with the union, and Stellantis said it had a productive meeting with the UAW's leader and is reviewing the union's demands. And finally, many companies are finding that their new hires this year are unprepared for work. After years of remote learning, students entering the workforce for professional service jobs are struggling with basic skills. And the data backs that up. Since the pandemic began in 2020, pass rates on national certifications and assessment exams taken by engineers, office workers, soldiers, and nurses have all fallen. Our education reporter Doug Belkin says now the responsibility has fallen to companies to make up for worker shortcomings by providing more on-the-job training.
In some cases, they're having to remediate them for hard skills, things that they should have learned when they were in high school or college and failed to learn or failed to master. And that can range from a specific skill in engineering, for instance, or some basic skills like math and communications. Some of the employment tests we saw, they show a decline in the ability to spell, in the ability to communicate, in attention to detail. So these are things that employers are having to double down on to make sure that their workers can handle.
And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. The show was produced by Anthony Bansi, Pierre Bien-Aimé, and Mohsen Ali, with help from Ariana Aspuru, Kate Bullivant, Julie Chang, Jessica Fenton, Zoe Thomas, and J.R. Whalen, and editorial support from Sandra Kilhoff, Michael Kosmides, Falana Patterson, Scott Salloway, and Chris Sinsley. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. We'll be back on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.